John McVane, ABC, United Nations. Ambassador Adlai Stevenson flew from New York to Trinidad this weekend on a special mission for President Kennedy to confer with President Arturo Frondizi of Argentina. Ambassador Stevenson has undertaken urgent discussions with the Argentine president on political and economic developments in Latin America, with special emphasis in Argentina. White House sources note this is a continuance of talks already begun between Mr. Stevenson and President Frondizi in October at the United Nations. They come at a time, I might add, when much hemisphere attention is focused on events in the Dominican Republic. Just before he flew to Trinidad, Mr. Stevenson taped the program you are about to see with Arnold Michaelis and special guest Edward R. Murrow, director of the United States Information Agency. How to explain to countries, friendly and unfriendly, that our purpose is peace? How to rally support on distant continents for our policies? These and other problems were before Ambassador Adlai Stevenson, his guest Edward R. Murrow, and Arnold Michaelis on the eve of Mr. Stevenson's departure.
That's good.
Well, Ed, I want to tell you how gratified I am that you could join us this afternoon on this program that we've been conducting here in an effort to familiarize people with what we're doing in diplomacy and in our foreign policy, and especially at the United Nations. You interviewed me a good many times when you were in the broadcasting business, and now it's my turn to interview you.
Well, Ed, how does it feel to be on this end of it?
Well, I have discovered already that it's rather easier to ask questions than to answer them, and I've also discovered that no question is indiscreet, but sometimes answers are. Is that a sound conclusion, Governor?
Yes, well, speaking for yourself.
Yeah.
But you can do both on this today, Ed.
All right.
Actually, both of you gentlemen are involved in more or less the same thing in different areas.
Well, I think our subject today, as I understood it, was to be communication.
Yes.
And I don't know anything more important, and I don't know anyone who knows more about that problem of communication on the vastest possible scale than Edward Murrow. So I think it's very kind of you to come here and to give us this opportunity to talk with our audience a little about your problems, and perhaps I can talk a little about mine. But mine are minuscule compared to yours.
No, I would not say that.
That's a matter of perspective, Governor. But Ed, with you, it used to be person to person, and now it's people to people, in spite of the fact that General Eisenhower is the honorary chairman of People to People. What essentially is the difference to you in terms of getting a story told worldwide?
Well, I think the essential difference between working in the private sector of communications and in the public sector is that in the private sector, I was working at least in the context largely of a domestic audience.
Yes.
This means that you can examine some of the social and economic conditions in some depth in what has sometimes been called an exposé, or if you like, muckraking, because you knew that your fellow countrymen could always put it in proper context, and they knew that if you were dealing with agricultural labor, migrant labor, that it was only one segment. Now, in trying to project the United States to the rest of the world, it is necessary to try to keep everything in balance so that you do not distort this terrible word image, which I dislike, but I haven't been able to produce a better substitute.
Of course, there's the other problem, which is the disadvantage that we're at, as long as we insist on dealing only in terms of the truth.
But isn't it better that
way? Who was it said that a falsehood travels round the world while the truth is pulling on its boots?
And this That's makes true.
This is a problem that I have. I'm sure you have it even in more acute form.
It is also true that, as Goebbels said, I think, that he who speaks the first word convinces much of the world. Mm. But it seems to me that we have no choice but to operate on the basis of truth.
I agree that. Of course, we have no choice. And that, of course, is our strength and also one of the difficulties that we confront. I run into it constantly here in the effort to make black white, to make words meaningless, to yesterday, I was engaged in an altercation with a delegate of Cuba who insisted that the United States had invaded the Dominican Republic. Well, you have this sort of problem to deal with all the time, and to communicate not only on the level of our General Assembly and the other members of the United Nations in many languages, but somehow to get beyond them to their governments at home. is a problem that we often have with our problems here, with our issues, our positions.
But insofar as telling our story to the world is concerned, gentlemen, both of you, you on the global end of it, Ed, do we give the impression to people around the world that we're trying to impose in any way our democracy upon them in terms of foreign aid, in terms of telling our story?
We can't impose either democracy or prosperity. The only thing we can do, it seems to me, is to give people in the emerging countries an opportunity to make a free choice without coercion. And if what they choose is not a carbon copy of our system,
yes,
then at least it is their choice.
Well, I think there was an example of that just recently, Ed, when the governor first came here to the United Nations. He made the statement that the United Nations, to him, seemed an extension of Western ideas, Western ideology, when it was first formed among the 51 member nations. Well, now it's increased to 103 member nations, made up of many countries from Asia and Africa, which don't have our tradition, don't have our background at all. Yet, in the selection of U Thant as temporary Secretary General, they seem to side entirely with our point of view.
By Western, an extension of Western ideas, I meant to say that the United Nations is based on the principle of one vote for one, per nation,
yes,
on equality of treatment, equal opportunity, human dignity, respect for human rights, and all of those things that are enshrined in the Charter and also in our philosophy. That's what I meant. It wasn't the fact that it was Western ideals in a projection of Western ideals in the sense that all of the people were Western or that they all shared our ideals, but the organization itself is parliamentary in its procedures. Every country has the same has a vote, and we respect one another, and of course it's been the forum for the smaller powers as well as for the large to express their views and to make their influence and opinion understood and heard in the world. And that's what I meant.
Ed, what would you say is the most difficult aspect of our image, to use that word again, that you have in getting across to peoples throughout the world?
Well, I would think the most difficult aspect of it is to persuade people abroad that we are not interested in sanctifying the status quo, that we have not departed from our revolutionary heritage, that we are not allergic to change. And I would think beyond that, it is to persuade them that we share their hopes, their dreams, and their ambitions, and that people who are determined to be free deserve and will get our support. In short, that we are not fat in a world where most of the people are lean and hungry, but to convince them that our interest in their welfare is not philanthropy, it is an association. It is a feeling that we share their aspiration. This is very difficult to do because, after all, what we are trying to project, it seems to me, is a very complex and sophisticated system of governance. And we are trying to do this to people who in many cases have no sense of national allegiance or belonging. They may have only tribal loyalties. And this is why, as one who has spent most of his life in the field of electronic journalism, I become more and more concerned with print, with books, mm-hmm, with the basic ideas. One of the most exciting things I have seen in a long while, and you will appreciate this, Adley, was in Mexico City only a couple of weeks ago, seeing a 14-year-old youngster reading the Federalist Papers, translated in Spanish. It is this sort of thing, I think, that we must convey. Do you agree?
Yes, I haven't seen many 14-year-old boys around my house reading the Federalist Papers. I can see.
Well, I will tell you one thing. We opened a library in a small country in Africa, and in 6 weeks recorded more requests for the Federalist Papers than have been recorded by the New York Public Library.
Isn't that singular?
These people are interested in going back to our beginnings, to our root holds. We have lost this habit. We have become so much concerned about the new purpose, the new objective of the United States, that we have failed to recognize that we've got the basic papers and the basic documents, if only we will adhere to them in practice.
Of course, in my travels around the world, I've noticed that how deficient we are in the circulation of America's basic literature, in both in cheap editions that people can afford and also in multiple languages. in contrast to the Iron Curtain countries, the Soviet Union, China, especially, where you find such vast masses of their literature on the show, on the bookstands of the world. What can we do about that?
It requires, one, better planning, two, more money. What is happening now is quite simple. We are being outbroadcast. We rank third at the moment behind the Soviet Union and Communist China in terms of shortwave broadcasting.
But actually,
in terms of publishing, last year the Soviet Union moved from 30 million books in translation in non-block languages from 30 million to 40 million. We and the agency managed under forced draft to publish under 9 million books in translation. We have got to come more to believe in the potency of ideas.
But Ed, you were cut actually, weren't you, on appropriations this year?
Well, we were cut from what we asked, yes.
Yes.
But we had an overall increase.
But you're down
compared
to about 110 million, isn't it?
111.5 in dollars.
And I understand that the Soviet Union is spending a sum equal to that amount just in jamming our stuff in the Voice of America.
They're spending more than that. They're spending roughly $125 million a year in jamming the Voice of America alone.
Good grace.
That's more than the total USIA output, then, isn't it?
That's right. If you want another figure, we have less to spend each year than the cost of one combat-loaded Polaris submarine.
I never knew your voice was so potent.
Well, it's a tribute to it.
Maybe you ought to have a record of reasonably poor performance for a while so that you can get some extra money.
Well, we're going to try for more next year. We shall see what happens.
What is the... one of the problems that I have in diplomacy is the problem of language, the misinterpretation of words, the fact that words don't often translate identically with our understanding of them.
Gentlemen, this whole problem of language that we seem to be having was forecast, actually, in the 11th chapter of Genesis, dealing with the Tower of Babel, where there was one language and one people on the earth, and the Lord is said to have confounded that one language into many and scattered the people abroad so that they couldn't talk to each other nor understand each other if they did. And I'm constantly reminded of that when I see the delegates to any of the sessions at the United Nations listening to the translations on their little receivers. That it looks to me as though they're trying to get back to that one tongue. Do you think we're going to make it?
Tower of Babel certainly grew to the East River. We have five official languages, as I'm sure Ed knows, in the United Nations: English, French, Spanish, Chinese, Russian. And now the proceedings move very rapidly because you can turn your dial to any language that you want to hear. Therefore, you can hear any speaker in any language that you select. And this makes it very convenient. In so far as the formal proceedings are concerned. But when you're walking around in the halls, in the corridors, and when you're out at lunch, and when you're out at dinner, and all of your constant contacts with delegates from other countries whose language you don't speak, it's very difficult. The Russians, for example, almost always have interpreters with them. We don't. But it's a difficulty that we have to overcome by having people who, for the most part, have some linguistic facility. But it still is an acute problem, the problem of communication. And it's especially different for these new countries who haven't got people who have any broad lingual education. The consequence is that they're limited mostly to their one language. It's an acute problem.
But even with the interpreters, Governor, I'm reminded of what Mr. Nehru told us in relation to the communique which he and Chou En-lai wanted to write after the Geneva meetings to express the spirit of what took place. And Mr. Nehru was asked to draft a sample of the communique, which he did. And when it was translated into the Chinese, Chou En-lai said that there were words there that had a totally different meaning from the Chinese. And Mr. Nehru said that these were not on any important areas of substance. That they were unimportant words, but they meant something totally different in Chinese.
It puts a premium on the simplicity of expression so that you minimize the risk of translating badly or being misunderstood. But it's awfully hard to get nuances in translation. It's awfully hard to get when you use the word yes, oh yes.
That's the point.
Oh, yes.
Well, yes, I think I agree with what you say, but I want to have a lot more time to think about it.
Also, the matter of the weight that words carry in terms of the experience of the individual. For example, a simple word like fire, which translates very well in most languages. Fire means something to one who has seen only a bonfire in the backyard. It means something totally different to someone who has seen an entire city burn. And part of our problem seems to me to balance the weight of the words so that experience comes in to bearing here.
Well, now, are the weight of our words, Ed, in your opinion, seeping more and more into the material, both printed and oral, that we're disseminating throughout the world?
Well, in many areas, we are working with a very simple English, with a vocabulary of less than 1,000 words.
For the Voice of America?
Yes, in some of the broadcasts. The same is true in the narration for films, television. An effort to make our meaning clear when we are not working in translation. Of course, we work in the Voice of America in 36 languages, in some cases up to 48, but there is always this constant problem of the accurate and meaningful translation.
To what extent are you able to communicate, do you think, now behind the Iron Curtain, be it in China or the Soviet Union or Eastern Europe?
It's very difficult because we have no rating system, as you know. But we were reckoned to get through perhaps 60% of the material broadcast to the Soviet Union. Much of this is in the rural areas because they have about 2,000 jammers. Those jammers are mainly concentrated in the urban areas. And sometimes when we cannot be heard in Moscow, for example, 20 miles outside Moscow, the signal is perfectly clear. Mm-hmm. So a large part of our audience behind the Iron Curtain is the rural audience. And therefore we tailor our programs to that audience. They never jam the English transmissions, and their jamming is selective. And if you study the jamming pattern, you can sense the location of their nerve ends. For example, in recent weeks, they will jam anything that has to do with Berlin, with nuclear testing, with Laos, with the state of food production in the Soviet Union. And this will vary from week to week. So it gives some indication of the area of sensitivity.
You say they never jam the English. You mean the British?
No, our English.
Well, that's singular because I was in the Soviet Union some years ago at the time of the Lebanon crisis, the landing. And I was in Central Asia and also in Eastern Siberia. And we had with us a receiving machine, instrument, a very, very, very fine one. And tried to listen to the news, the broadcasts of the Voice of America and the BBC, and everything was jammed.
Well, they're not always efficient, you see.
We have the feeling sometimes that the Russians do everything with great precision and great skill. There have been times when they have jammed themselves. For example, when we are transmitting a talk that Gromyko may be making in the United Nations, they have jammed their comrade Gromyko, so they're not as efficient, but
maybe
by and large.
Maybe that was efficient.
But by and large, they do not jam the transmissions in English, either ours or the BBC.
Really?
But we do have occasionally some indication of effectiveness. For example, a few weeks ago, in the course of our broadcast to Yugoslavia, which are not jammed, we offered a giveaway of certain small transistor receiving sets. And we made a few announcements each day for a period of a week, and received 18,300 letters from Yugoslavia.
Well, you know you're getting through.
Which is an indication that someone is listening.
Well, you've been utilizing all lines and means of communications, Ed. I read with interest of what you had done in Laos, which I know the governor would find enormously interesting.
Oh, well, this is a very simple device. They have the tradition of traveling troubadours who sing songs that have to do with current events. So we simply used a group of troubadours to sing and tell stories with anti-communist content designed to support and sustain the government of Laos. And people listened. Now, what they did after they listened, no one knows, but at least we had an audience. We have certain publications in Asia, for example, that pass for currency. And no publication in the United States can make this claim, because people who operate ferries will accept these publications in lieu of payment in cash.
Well, in view of this involvement, Ed, it's pretty hard to think of your operation as being foreign and what we do here as being domestic. Aren't we getting to a point now where it's almost becoming one?
Ours is foreign by legislation. We have no constituency in this country, unlike the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Labor, Defense. Everything we do is for export. Most of it is invisible. Our results are intangible, and normally we receive domestic publicity when we fall on our face.
Yes. Well, I think what he'd also agree that there are no domestic issues anymore, yes. And that everything he has to deal with, everything that transpires has a foreign aspect nowadays. This is one of the great changes, it seems to me, that's overtaken the world in this century, and especially the United States, which is so profoundly involved everywhere, in everything, in every item that comes before, of every 90 odd items on the agenda of the United Nations in this General Assembly, the United States is involved literally in every one of them. It's the most extraordinary thing, the extent to which we are implicated.
How does that
throughout the world, politically, economically, and of course, militarily.
But how does that compare, Governor, vis-a-vis the Soviet Union?
They likewise are extremely widely involved, but perhaps somewhat less than we are. But I suppose it's without a counterpart, and maybe we're too involved.
Well, the Soviet Union is not so involved because they are able to control the export of information. See, everything that happens here, people talk of the Voice of America, our own radio operation. This represents a very small segment of the whole spectrum of communication, because a speech made by a senator in his hometown, the picture of a burning bus in Alabama, will have much more importance than anything that we can do. For example, we have about 1,200 people abroad. There are 30,000 missionaries. There are more than 1 million military personnel and their dependents abroad. The whole output of Hollywood, the export of television programs abroad, have much greater impact than anything that we can do, because their volume is greater.
Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, I'd like to ask you both what effect you think Cuba's attack upon us in the Security Council has had upon the other member nations of the Organization of American States, to the effect that we interfered in the internal affairs of the Dominican Republic.
Well, from the debates in the United Nations, I don't think it's had any impact whatsoever, because I think it's been very clear to all of the participants, both in the OAS and in the United Nations, all as well as the bystanders, that at last freedom has come, that the Trujillos have been ejected, and that the Dominican Republic has an opportunity to join the family of free and independent states and establish democratic institutions after 32 years of dictatorship, and that this has been made possible, as their own representatives testified here in New York the other day. It made possible in large measure by the encouragement of the United States.
Did you have the feeling during your swing through Latin America, Ed, that Cuba had made any great impact upon the peoples of the various countries there?
It's made an impact, certainly. It is diminishing. The appeal of Castroism is much less in the cities now than it was a few months ago. Still has considerable appeal in the countryside, not because of communist ideology, but simply because of land reform.
I think the Latin American has looked at the Cuban Revolution, and this has been one of our problems of communication, as a social reform, long overdue, highly desirable, not as the introduction of communism into the Western Hemisphere. This has been one of our problems of communication, I think, a very good example of it.
This illustrates one thing we are doing now in our broadcast in Spanish and Portuguese to Latin America. We're using almost exclusively Cuban refugees, and almost entirely refugees who initially supported Castro, in an effort to demonstrate mm-hmm. the degree and extent to which the aims of the revolution have been betrayed.
Ed mentioned a while ago about the Alliance for Progress not being very well known throughout Latin America, but that the planned Kennedy was. Now, I wonder how much both of you feel the impact of personality, figures, in diplomacy, Governor, with you, with image building, Ed, telling our story around the world. How much of an impact does the individual personality have in these areas?
Oh, I think a great deal. I think individuals have, because of the press and the convenience of ready reference and identification of peoples through the symbolism of an individual, they have a great deal to do with the with people's understanding.
I would only add to that, Governor, that in Latin America, you do.
Thank you.
Well, I didn't want to bring up the subject of personality where both of you are concerned, because obviously the impact of the personality of each of you has been great in the areas in which you have been working. And I, for one, wish you continued success in both of these areas. It has to be successful if we're going to survive.
Well, I appreciate your coming to join us very much, Ed, on this this effort we're making to communicate with the people of the United States about our problems in diplomacy and foreign policy and at the United Nations. These kind of exchanges, we think, have some value and in an effort to communicate to people the problems that we confront and the difficulties that we have. And I must say, no one is better known to the radio audience, a television audience in the United States than you are. And I hope we can induce you to come back and help educate us.
Well, Adlai, I would like to add only one thing. I have the feeling that many of us in this country are accustomed to expect easy, quick, dramatic solutions. It seems to me we are now in a phase of our national existence where there ain't going to be any quick, certainly no easy solutions. And this is going to require more patience, more fortitude, more self-discipline on the part of this country than we have ever been required to display.
I wonder if there ever were any quick answers to any.
Well, we thought there were.
It reminds me of the remark that a fellow made one time. He said, things aren't as good as they used to be, and the other one said they never were.
The old days are the good old days because they aren't anymore, is that it?
Ed, I hope you'll come back and communicate with us again.
I'd like to.
Adlai Stevenson will shortly return from Trinidad, where he has been talking with President Frondizi of Argentina. 2 weeks from today, our guest will be Argentine Ambassador to the UN, Dr. Mario Amadeo. Be sure to join us when Adlai Stevenson reports in conversation with Arnold Michaelis.
Rainey doesn't sing anymore. Not anywhere in the world.
One song meant certain death. Did she dare raise her voice? See Follow the Sun. 7:30 Eastern, 6:30 Central Time.
Tonight on ABC.